10, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think.
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 Silence is not an option.
Obama picks Elena Kagan for the Supreme Court. BP struggles to contain the oil spill, and Marcy Winograd challenges Blue Dog Democrat Jane Harman.
Sorry if my eyes drop when the fellow meadows out, but I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. President Barack Obama formally announced yesterday the selection of Solicitor General Elena Kagan as his nominee for the United States Supreme Court. From the East Room of the White House, Obama described his choice as one of the nation's foremost legal minds and an acclaimed legal scholar with a rich understanding of constitutional law. If confirmed to replace the seat held by retiring Justice John Paul Stevens, Kagan would become the youngest serving member of the High Court and, for the first time in history, its third woman. Prior to her current responsibilities as the president's solicitor general, Kagan was a tenured professor at the University of Chicago before going on to become the first woman to be dean of the Harvard Law School. Unlike other nominees in recent history, she has had no previous judicial experience, a point conservative detractors are expected to criticize. Though Kagan has called the military's "don't ask, don't tell" discriminatory policies on gays a moral injustice, her nomination is hardly seen by progressive analysts as a solidly liberal one, balancing out a more conservative court. Attention has been drawn to her Senate confirmation hearings for Solicitor General when she agreed with Senator Lindsey Graham on the controversial War on Terror power of the presidency to indefinitely hold detainees as, quote, enemy combatants. Once a paid advisor for Goldman Sachs during the mortgage crisis, Kagan has also drawn progressive ire for hosting a dinner for Justice Antonin Scalia while introducing him on the occasion of his 20th anniversary on the Supreme Court. My guest is Francis Boyle, a professor of law at the University of Illinois and the author of Tackling America's Toughest Questions. He joins me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising, Professor Boyle.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, and best to your listening audience.
So first, are you surprised by the choice that President Obama has made?
No, not at all. They've been telegraphing this choice for a number of months. So it's obviously very disappointing. She's the worst choice that Obama could have made. Judge Wood up here in the Seventh Circuit, where I'm licensed to practice, would have been an excellent choice, and I really don't know what to say.
Let's hear an excerpt of President Obama's announcement yesterday.
While we can't presume to replace Justice Stevens's wisdom or experience, I have selected a nominee who I believe embodies that same excellence, independence, integrity, and passion for the law, and who can ultimately provide that same kind of leadership on the court. Our Solicitor General, and my friend, Elena Kagan.
Well, Francis Boyle, he used the words excellence, independence, integrity, and passion for the law. Why don't you like Elena Kagan?
Well, I mean, there are a variety of points. First, when she was dean of Harvard Law School, she covered up three plagiarism scandals by Larry Tribe, Charles Ogletree, and Alan Dershowitz. Because they were her star professors. And I think that alone indicates her total lack of any ethical integrity to serve on the Supreme Court. If I had done that or any of my students had done that, I would have been fired and they would have been expelled. As for the replacing Justice Stevens, she, both in her tenure at Harvard Law School, and also in her hires at Harvard Law School, and also during her year as Solicitor General, she has proven to be a loyal presidential apparatchik upholding the Bush War on Terrorism policies, which, by the way, Justice Stevens attempted to counteract there at the Supreme Court. So we are now going to be seeing the Supreme Court move even farther to the right than it currently is. In addition, during her tenure at Harvard Law School, She hired 32 tenure-track professors. Only one was a professor of color. All the rest were white. Kagan believes in affirmative action for conservative white males, as if we don't have enough of them in American legal education today, and especially at Harvard Law School, where I went starting back in 1971. Her academic record is abysmal. She really has none to speak of. And the only reason she got the job at Harvard Law School was that she was a crony of Larry Summers in the Clinton administration. So when Summers became president of Harvard, he took someone with almost no academic credentials at all and appointed her as dean. As for the statement by President Obama that you did not quote, that she would care about the common people of America, that's preposterous. As you correctly pointed out, she was paid to be on the board of Goldman Sachs, responsible for our current economic crisis, which, by the way, Larry Summers bailed out there. Her mentor, Larry Summers, bailed out while at the White House. In addition, while Larry Summers was president of Harvard, Mr. Globalization, of a $400 million capital campaign that Kagan launched, she publicly stated that she was going to allocate $20 million to promoting globalization at Harvard Law School by hiring professors and programs that would support globalization. And we all know the terrible things that globalization has done to the common, ordinary people of America today of all colors. So she's just going to be in there to do the dirty work of big business, big banks like Goldman Sachs.
What about Elena Kagan's link to the Federalist Society, and what should people know about the Federalist Society?
Right. While she was Solicitor General for the Department of Justice, this was as recently as December, she was asked on the National Public Radio her opinion on the Federalist Society. And this is not just her position as Dean of the Harvard Law School, but as U.S. Solicitor General. And she said, quote, "I love the Federalist Society," unquote. And that was her her emphasis. Well, that's just appalling that there she is, U.S. Solicitor General. She is in charge of supervising and quarterbacking and arguing all litigation in United States federal courts up to and including the United States Supreme Court. And the Federalist Society lawyers were the Bush lawyers who were responsible for every hideous atrocity that the Bush administration inflicted on civil rights, civil liberties, human rights, international law, and the Bill of Rights.
And so essentially it's an organization of very conservative and libertarian lawyers.
It's an organization of extreme right-wing lawyers. They're against Brown versus the Board of Education. They want to overturn it. Almost all of the lawyers involved in the Bush torture scandal were Federalist Society lawyers like Professor John Yoo up there at Berkeley or Goldschmidt at Harvard, whom she hired, despite the fact I made it clear to her and the other Harvard Law School faculty that Goldschmidt was up to his nose in torture, war crimes, enforced disappearances, and the Gitmo kangaroo courts. And when the Washington Post published one of Goldschmidt's memos authorizing kidnapping people from Iraq and then shipping them off to other countries to be tortured, Kagan, as dean of the Harvard Law School, in response said, quote, "how proud," unquote, she was to have hired Goldschmidt, her pet war criminal. This is a woman that is completely unscrupulous. She has no principles, none at all. She has spent her career as a Democratic Party apparatchik. She worked for Clinton. on the what can only be called the welfare reform legislation. I think the list goes on when you take a look at it. And as for her record in the law, she is even more underqualified than Harriet Myers. At least Harriet Myers practiced law for many years. She was the managing partner of a very distinguished law firm in Dallas, I believe, and head of the Texas Bar Association. Kagan has nothing to her credit. And it seems to me that if the right wing of the Republican Party knocked Myers out of there, at a minimum, I think people of good faith and goodwill should get Kagan out of there and convince President Obama that, you know, we would like someone consistent with the promise of change that he made to us during the campaign.
And a little bit of background, Harriet Myers was the was President Bush's nominee for the Supreme Court, and she did not pass the nomination. My guest is Francis Boyle, a professor of law at the University of Illinois. He's the author of several books, his latest, Tackling America's Toughest Questions. We're talking about the selection by President Obama of Elena Kagan as his nomination for the Supreme Court of the United States to replace Justice John Paul Stevens. So now, why do you think President Obama has made this pick? And of course, the right wing is already coming at Elena Kagan as not being conservative enough. It seems as though he's doing the same thing he's done in the past, sort of starting from the center instead of starting from the left.
Well, we have to understand Kagan is not a centrist at all. She's to the right.
So he's pandering to the right, not even starting to the
left. That is correct.
Okay.
And I think he figures that you know, he can get her through with no problem. But the reason, in my opinion, I have no direct pipeline to President Obama or his inner circle, but she's a partisan of the hyper-imperial presidency. She wrote a very tendentious tome in the Harvard Law Review. I haven't read the whole thing, but I've read the abstract. And it basically is the Federalist Society doctrine of the unitary power, executive power theory of the presidency, that basically the president can do whatever he wants. And this really goes back to Thomas Hobbes and the Leviathan, the blueprint for a modern totalitarian state. So by putting Kagan up there, Obama figures he'll get whatever he wants out of her, no independence, and basically just a rubber stamp. Whereas Diane Wood here in the Seventh Circuit has written critically on many of the abuses committed by President Bush. As we've seen with her as U.S. Solicitor General during the past year, she has continued and justified and defended in court every hideous atrocity that the Bush administration inflicted on anyone. There has been no retreat. Even the Ninth Circuit out there was amazed to find out that the Department of Justice was not changing its position on state secrets, and the list of these types of things go on. Mm. So she's in there to continue to uphold massive presidential powers now being wielded by Obama and his minions, and she's one of them. It's just like the Harriet Myers selection of sort of an in-house counsel to do Bush's dirty work for him on the Supreme Court.
And so you would suggest that progressives take a page out of the right-wing handbook and oppose Elena Kagan for not being progressive enough and push President Obama and Democrats to get a much more liberal justice to not only replace Justice Stevens, but perhaps help rebalance the court, if you will, which is now very seriously tilted to the right.
That's correct. And even if you take a look at today's New York Times, you'll see a story and a chart. This is, you know, one of the most right-wing Supreme Courts we've had since I guess Herbert Hoover's Supreme Court before Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. and it needs to be nudged in the other direction. And Kagan is only going to bring it farther, much farther to the right. That's what we're going to see here. She'll be. We already have 5 Federalist Society members on the Supreme Court: Roberts, Alito, Thomas, Scalia, and Kennedy, the 5 horsemen of the apocalypse. She'll be number 6, and it will basically solidify Federalist Society control of the Supreme Court, corporate control of the Supreme Court for the next generation.
Well, Francis Boyle, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. And again, I'd encourage everyone out there to contact your senators and oppose Kagan's nomination.
Francis Boyle is a professor of law at the University of Illinois and the author of Tackling America's Toughest Questions. We've been talking about Elena Kagan, a Supreme Court nominee just picked by President Obama officially. This is Uprising, and we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we will take another look at the ongoing oil spill off of the Gulf Coast and what BP is doing to stop it, if anything, and what Plan B is after the first plan has failed. We'll speak with somebody from Greenpeace. After that, today's subversive historian, and then a conversation with Marcy Winograd in studio. She's running against Jane Harman to represent California's 36th district. Stay tuned.
Donate your used car, truck, or boat to the KPFK Vehicle Donation Program. It's an easy way to help support KPFK and receive a tax deduction. All you have to do is call 877-KPFK-AUTO or donate at kpfk.org. An operator will arrange a good time to pick up your vehicle. 877-KPFK-AUTO or go online to kpfk.org.
The Glendale Peace Vigil will be holding a screening of Rethink Afghanistan on Friday, May 7th at 7 p.m. at the Glendale Central Library. This hard-hitting documentary from Robert Greenwald and Brave New Films is a brutally honest expose of U.S. military escalation, Pakistan's entanglement, and the costs of war on civilians and especially Afghan women. The film will be followed by a discussion as well as a hip-hop poetry performance. That's Rethink Afghanistan, screening this Friday at 7 p.m. at the Glendale Central Library, 222 East Harvard Street. For more information, call 818-242-4320 or 818-484-5635.
This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. BP's latest attempt to stem the flow of oil from the Deepwater Horizon offshore rig explosion has failed. The UK-based oil giant, which operated the rig, had planned an ambitious effort to lower a 98-ton dome over the leak to try to funnel up the oil. But ice crystals formed from gas and high pressures and clogged the dome, forcing the effort to be abandoned. BP engineers are now in the process of manufacturing a second, smaller dome to funnel away the oil. The move by oil companies toward drilling in greater and greater depths in their search for oil has come at a heavy price. Meanwhile, thick deposits of crude oil have been discovered in one of the channels of the Mississippi River, and some crews have found a green, scum-like mixture of oil and chemical dispersants around the Mississippi Delta. Oil-soaked birds are more commonly being seen, and tar balls have begun washing up on the shores of Alabama's Dauphin Island, severely curtailing tourism in the area. It is estimated that 3.5 million gallons of oil have already gushed into the waters off of the Gulf Coast from the continuously expelling oil reserve. Meanwhile, a shareholder has filed a lawsuit against BP executives, possibly triggering a wave of class action lawsuits from other shareholders. The costs of cleanup have already cost BP $350 million and is likely to run into the billions. Of the more than 5,000 lawsuits filed against the company, BP has already processed about 650 and paid out $3 million. My guest is Dan Howells. He is a deputy campaigns director with Greenpeace, currently in Louisiana. Welcome to Uprising, Dan.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing very well. Thanks so much for joining us. So first, can you tell us what is Greenpeace doing in Louisiana and off of the Gulf Coast? What role are you playing in this whole disaster?
Well, it's started with a big part of what Greenpeace does and a lot of other environmental groups do is bear witness. And so our first instinct was to come down here and see what was going on and to try and document as much as we could. We've had a photographer up in an airplane, and we our boat, one of our boats just arrived yesterday. So we've been going out to areas where the oil spill is. But probably more importantly, we've been taking trips out into the bayou the last couple of days, where we have seen globules of oil washing up on the beaches, getting onto some of the oil booms right at the mouth of the Mississippi, which is scary because it shows it's definitely coming inland. And we're going to go probably in about an hour or so. We're going to head out again to a couple of other areas where we've heard of oil coming ashore on mainland now, so it passed all the barrier islands and actually getting closer and closer into Louisiana.
What do you make of the efforts by BP, who understand that not only are they trying to clean up the oil spill, but their own reputation? And after this first effort to lure this massive dome has failed, they are working on a second one. Do you think that they're making a good faith effort?
A good colleague, a friend and colleague of mine put it well that they seem to be working harder on their image than they are working on stopping this mess. They're putting effort into it. You know, they need to get this thing capped and get it capped so that, you know, the 200,000 plus gallons of oil a day estimated to be spilling into the Gulf will stop. The question, so they're making some good faith efforts, but you really can't clean this up. You can stop the spills from these breakouts from happening that they've got down there right now, but all their cleanup efforts are largely part of their PR efforts. At best, estimates say you can only get about 90% of the oil will still escape. And then when you add into the dispersants that they're putting in there, which is even more toxic, and really what the dispersants are doing is keeping the oil from coming up to the surface so that we can't see it. So, you know, they're making some efforts. We're glad they're making some efforts. They need to cap those things so the oil stops spilling. They need to work less on their PR and be more honest with the public about what's actually happening down there.
Today, there are a number of hearings that are happening, a number of Senate committees that are going to be interviewing and getting testimony from the companies involved, BP chief among them, but also Transocean, that is the company that owns the rig. It was operated by BP, but Transocean owns it. And then Halliburton, which is the company that poured the cement. And now some of that cement that was used in the oil rig is coming under scrutiny because they were using apparently a novel approach to mix the cement, and attempts to figure out what caused the explosion are certainly going on in Congress as well as in Louisiana. Dan Howells is my guest, Deputy Campaigns Director with Greenpeace. We're talking to him live from Louisiana. Now, you talked about the, you know, 90% of the oil will continue to escape and will remain out there, but what about efforts like old-fashioned efforts, low-tech efforts, like just getting enough booms out there to absorb the oil?
Well, you can put putting the booms out there is a good thing. But you can put as many booms as you want out. The fact of the matter is they shouldn't have been drilling in the first place. We need to stop going towards fossil fuels, or we need to just get away from fossil fuels. We had, you know, last month we had a disaster in the mountains. This month we have a disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, how much longer our company is going to, you know, BP made $5.6 billion in the last quarter alone or something like that. How much longer are we going to let them get away with doing that and not turn towards the energy future with renewable energies? I mean, it's just ridiculous that this kind of stuff keeps happening. So, you know, booms, they're good, they should be doing them, but there's a much, much larger problem out there, which is we continue to drill and mine in places that we shouldn't be doing it.
Are there any other solutions to tackling this disaster, the fact that it has happened and is already affected the livelihoods of so many people and will continue to affect the livelihoods of lots of folks, including, of course, enormous and perhaps irreversible damage to the environment for many, many decades? Are there any solutions or innovative solutions that BP is overlooking that they could be trying?
No, it's kind of funny. And another colleague of mine said they're using one of the oldest tools in the book, which is fire. They're trying to light some of this stuff on fire. But even that, I honestly don't know that there's much out there that you can do. You would think they'd be prepared, but this is kind of like catching water in water, and it's just not easy to do. You can't clean this stuff up. Once it's out in the ecosystem and it's damaging the economy down here, the environment down here, there's not a heck of a lot you can do about it. So the real solution is to not drill in the first place.
So you recommend that out of this entire tragedy, what listeners can take away is to ensure that more such things don't happen in the future.
Yeah, it's time people stop saying, oh yeah, we'll get to renewables, but in the meantime, we're going to keep drilling. We're way past the meantime here. We need to stop drilling. We need to take all the profits that these companies are making, and they need to turn their attention towards energy sources that aren't going to spill oil or drop boulders from mountaintop removal or damage our air and cause climate change from burning coal. We just have to get away from it. And I'm not sure how many more wake-up calls Congress, the president, and these companies are going to need than the ones we've had just in the last couple of months.
Dan Howells, what is the damage to wildlife in the area, not just, of course, the fish, the shrimp that are part of the economy, but also the birds in the area?
Well, the one nice thing for BP is that the dispersion is keeping the oil below the surface. We already talked a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems they've made a decision to kill the fish to keep the birds from ending up on the front page of the New York Times or something like that.
Because birds are more visual?
Well, birds are more visual, but we need to remember, what do the birds eat? The birds eat the fish.
Hmm.
So with the bird, and they're diving birds as well. So at some point, when the fish, when we start getting dead fish washing up, or even fish that are still alive but are now toxic because they're living in this mess, and the birds start eating those fish, that's going to affect the birds. So the whole ecosystem here is really at danger. And there was, I think, something like 10 sea turtles washed up on the beach a couple of days ago over in Biloxi or over in that area. I mean, this is just, the ecological disaster is going to affect all the critters, but it's also going to affect all the humans economically, and who knows what it's going to do to people health-wise as well in the long run.
There's been...
I mean, that's the thing. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead and finish your thought.
No, I just think that one of the things, there's a gentleman we've been working with down here who's been taking us out on his boat, and he's born and raised down here. He's been fishing and shrimping and his whole life. He built the boat that we went out on in his backyard, and he said to me the other day, it's like, BP's going to come down here, they're going to do their little cleanup scenario, they're going to leave, and everyone who lives down here is going to be stuck with mess. And I'm not sure anyone can put it any better than that.
There's been much made of some of the birds that have been rescued and are now being re-released. What will happen to them when they start eating toxic fish or can't get to fish, it will remain to be seen. And also compensation to some of the fishermen, again, what will happen once they can't fish 5-10 years down the line. All of that remains to be seen in the future. Finally, Dan Howells, what do you think about this new effort to build a smaller dome, which is going to take at least another week to try to cap the leak, and the fact that the earlier one got clogged up with all of the ice crystals? Any sense that this latest effort may have some measure of success?
Well, I certainly hope it does. I mean, get those things capped, stop the oil spewing into the Gulf. So I hope it does. I really do. The bigger question is, why didn't they have these things ready to go in case of emergency or in case of a blowout like we've got right now? Why did we have to build them afterwards? Why didn't we have better protections in place to stop this from happening in the first place? And a lot of that has to do with lobbying on Capitol Hill and our government letting them kind of get away with not being prepared for this. And I think that's one of the, out of the multitude of reasons to be really angry about what's going on down here, that's, you know, one of the bigger ones.
Do you think that the president is taking a hard enough line on BP?
I think they're saying some good things. I think they've got a lot of work to do.
Well, Dan Howells, can you throw out Greenpeace's website?
I think it's just greenpeace.org. Greenpeace, GREENPEACE.org. We're blogging from down here. We've got some great photographers working with us down here. And so if nothing else, there's some really good photographs being taken, and check out the website and always give us a call if you have any questions.
And that's greenpeace.org. Dan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Dan Howells is the Deputy Campaigns Director with Greenpeace, joining us live via cell phone from Louisiana. He's been going out on boats to witness what's happening in the Gulf Coast. This is Uprising. After today's Subversive Historian, we'll be joined live in studio by Marcy Winograd. Stay tuned.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your Subversive Historian. Back in the day, on May 11th, 1894, 3,000 workers staged a wildcat strike in Pullman, Illinois. As an economic recession gripped the nation, the notorious George M. Pullman targeted cutbacks against hourly workers employed in his Pullman Palace Car Company. The conditions for many of the non-management employees were already untenable prior to the wage cuts and layoffs, and with Pullman City once described as a relic of European serfdom, workers had few options at their disposal. Nevertheless, the Pullman strike commenced, and in June 1894, the American Railway Union voted to refuse work on any train that carried a Pullman car, and by doing so, effectively took the stoppage national. The Pullman strike would end later that summer, however, when Attorney General Richard Olney obtained an injunction at the behest of President Cleveland to deploy the U.S. Army to break the boycott. And here I was, thinking capitalism really detested state intervention. For Uprising, this is your truth professor, saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Having once introduced herself as the best Republican in the Democratic Party, Congresswoman Jane Harman of California's 36th District may now regret those words. Harman, the second wealthiest member of Congress, faces a stiff challenge for her seat this year from community activist Marcy Winograd, co-founder of Progressive Democrats of America. In 2006, Winograd first went up against Harman, garnering nearly 40% of the vote in the primary election. Recently, at the California Democratic Convention in Los Angeles, she challenged the party's endorsement of Harman, leading to an impromptu debate between the two candidates. Jane Harman has long upset progressives with her so-called blue dot credentials, especially on foreign policy issues, including strong early support for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, an aggressive stand on Iran, and unconditional support for the State of Israel. She was a proponent of using warrantless wiretapping through the NSA under President Bush and made the controversial move to pressure the New York Times not to break its story. However, on domestic issues, Harman has supported universal health care, women's reproductive rights and access to abortions, LGBT rights and stem cell research. Marcy Winograd joins me in studio this morning. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you so much, Sonali. It's a great pleasure to be with you and your listeners this morning.
Thanks so much for joining us. So let's first talk about the event here in Los Angeles, the California Democratic Convention. We spoke with Norman Solomon at that time, I remember, in studio, and he told us about what was coming up. I want to play for listeners an excerpt of the exchange between yourself and Jane Harman on the issue of the economy. This is Marcy Winograd at the California Democratic Convention, and after that you'll hear Jane Harman responding to her.
I think that we need to revisit our economic agenda and say, you know what? We can no longer sustain, nor do we want to sustain, this permanent war economy. We need to transition to a new green economy What does this have to do with the race in the 36th congressional district? Everything. Because in our district, we have a huge aerospace industry. How criminal it is that we give our youth such limited choices. Build a bomb or build a rocket. You know what? We can harness the talent, the expertise, the know-how of this district to create productive jobs, to invest in housing, education, healthcare, transportation, not to perpetuate a war economy that is draining us, robbing us of money that we desperately need for our own needs.
Okay.
I challenge my opponent to stop voting for this war machine.
Okay. You know what? Slogans won't solve problems. Solving problems is hard. And the choice isn't between healthcare and warfare or jobs and war. The choice is between ways to project America's good values to create more peace in the world, which I am strongly for, and to understand that we also confront some evil in this world. And I strongly believe that. And if you don't believe that, you ought to travel to places like Yemen or the tribal areas of Pakistan, where there are many good and decent people, but there also are some people hiding out and about who are trying to attack us and everything we stand for.
And that's the voice of Jane Harmon responding to my guest, Marcy Winograd, who's the co-founder of the LA chapter of Progressive Democrats of America. Marcy Winograd, so respond to what Jane Harmon just said, that sometimes we have to do the hard things.
Well, to respond to that, I would say that it's a bit more complex, that we have to look at the sociological, political context in which terrorism occurs, and we have to look at how occupations and wars fuel insurgencies, that actions are not, they don't occur in and of themselves, they're reactions. And I would say we need a new foreign policy, one that embraces diplomacy and the rule of law and not looks to preemptive war to solve our problems. I don't see that as solving our problems. In fact, we see quite the opposite with these wars expanding perpetually. Let me just back up a minute and explain how this debate unfolded. It was not planned, as you mentioned, Sonali. It was impromptu. I have been asking my opponent, inviting her, let's put it that way, to debate for 4 years, ever since I first challenged her in 2006 and mobilized almost 40% of the vote in less than 3 months. I've been asking her to debate, and she has consistently refused. In fact, we even had a rabbi who offered his 800-seat sanctuary free, and she said no. Her position on the Middle East was clear. So it came as quite a surprise to both of us, actually, that this debate unfolded. And how it happened was this. We had both been invited to speak on a panel hosted by the Progressive Caucus, the largest caucus in the California Democratic Party. I was there. I RSVP'd, as you will. Jane Harmon was missing in action. I spoke for a bit, and then I had to excuse myself to vote in another election. And when I was out of the room, I got a call on my cell phone. Marcy, come back here. Jane Harmon just walked in as soon as you left. So I raced back to the room where the Progressive Caucus was holding its panel, and I quietly slipped back onto the panel, three bodies down from Jane Harmon. She did not see me, so it came as quite a surprise to her when I jumped in when she paused and asked her how she could justify being a member of the Blue Dog Coalition and saying that she was there because she was fiscally responsible, yet continually voting for near-trillion-dollar military budgets.
Mm. Marcy Winograd, what about the issue of representation? I mean, Jane Harmon would say that she represents California's 36th district. Why do you feel that you would be a better representative of the constituencies?
Jane Harmon has called herself the grandma of the Blue Dogs. Who are the Blue Dogs? They are corporate Democrats who voted, you know, pushed, lobbied for a bankruptcy bill in 2005 that really hurts working people in the sense that it punishes people who have to declare medical bankruptcy by making it very difficult for them to find work, to get credit again. It makes it much easier for big banks to foreclose on people's homes. It hikes our credit card rates sky high. So the Blue Dogs have aligned themselves very closely with Wall Street, and she is a member of the Blue Dog Coalition. Her district, however, the 36th Congressional District, which stretches 30 miles from West Los Angeles down through the beach cities into Torrance and the harbor, its registration, voter registration, is Democratic Party leading, has the Democratic Party leading the Republican Party by 18 percentage points. Roughly 150,000 Democrats, 90,000 Republicans, 70,000 declined to states. So we know that this is not a blue dog district. It's not a district that could swing either way. The race is the primary. So it seems that she is out of alignment with the people of her district in the positions that she has taken, not just on issues pertaining to Wall Street, but issues pertaining to war and peace.
Now, let's talk about the fact that she claims she is a progressive. And to justify that, she has touted the endorsement of the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey. She has also taken positions on the Armenian Genocide, co-sponsoring a bill to recognize, for the U.S. to recognize the Armenian Genocide, at least on paper. And she has also, as I said, supported social issues in a more liberal way, women's reproductive rights, LGBT rights, stem cell research, universal health care.
Okay, so we've got Lynn Woolsey, Armenian Genocide and women's rights. On the subject of women's rights, let's take that one first. It's true my opponent is pro-choice. I argue she is pro-choice and pro-war, which hurts women, hurts women and men and children all over the globe. I am pro-choice and pro-peace, certainly pro-diplomacy. In terms of women's rights to health care, my opponent, Jane Harman, many people don't realize this, she voted very recently during this whole health insurance reform debate to kill an amendment to the health care reform bill that would have given women affordable medication for cancer, for breast cancer, brain tumors, women and men suffering from cancer, Parkinson's, HIV. This was an amendment introduced by Congressman Henry Waxman that would have fast-tracked generics for biologics, expensive drugs for these very serious illnesses. She voted to give Big Pharma, and they thanked her for this publicly on the radio, she voted to give Big Pharma a 12-year monopoly to life. And I mentioned this in the debate on these very expensive drugs. So I don't see how that advances women's rights. On the issue of Armenian genocide, it's true, she did co-sponsor a resolution to condemn the Armenian genocide, the Holocaust of 1 to 2 million Armenians at the end of World War I. However, at the same time that she was listed as a co-sponsor, the Armenians in this city, Los Angeles, as well as nationally, got word that she was lobbying against her own legislation, calling people up and trying to round up votes to defeat it. So they were furious. They demanded a meeting. They were denied a meeting. Ultimately, they confronted her at another event, and they have been mobilized to support my candidacy. In fact, the Armenian National Committee has endorsed Winograd for Congress, and we have had a dozen members of the Armenian Youth Federation walking this district for my campaign since almost the beginning. Finally, in terms of Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey, who's from the north, from Sonoma, and her leadership as co-chair of the Progressive Caucus coming out to stump for Jane Harman, I have to say it's very disappointing. I wouldn't be honest to say anything less than that. I do want to point out that sometimes it's a matter of closing ranks. It's a matter of incumbents protecting each other because they're afraid that one day they may, too, be challenged. So our response is, you know what, we need a co-chair of the Progressive Caucus. We need leadership in that caucus that is going to support progressives, certainly not rubber stamp incumbents who vote against their interests, who take the nation to war without providing any oversight. This is a great betrayal.
And Jane Harman is quite an active member of Congress. She sits on a number of important and influential committees. I mentioned she's also the second wealthiest member of Congress, second only to Daryl Issa. My guest is Marcy Winograd, the woman who's challenging Jane Harman's seat in Congress, representing California's 36th district, and actually challenging the nomination of Jane Harman. And so you said the power of incumbency is very important. And the California Democratic Convention in Los Angeles, the method is you normally, the convention goes in with the party automatically endorsing the incumbents. But you did manage to challenge that and raise the question, what ultimately happened off that endorsement?
Well, Sonali, we collected over 500 signatures within a four-hour period on the Saturday night of the convention to pull her endorsement and to push it to a full-floor debate. And keep in mind, this was a raucous convention, and it was an uphill battle in the sense that Jane Harman's bodyguard, her chief of staff, I'm not sure, was there and doing everything he could to make sure that we had trouble collecting these signatures. We had representatives thrown out of the hotel for for approaching other delegates in the lobby. You know, it was quite wild, but in the end, there was a full-floor debate, despite the fact that the Democratic Party leadership, in an effort to censor this debate, tried to rush through the endorsement and put her back on the consent calendar with mute microphones and a lack of clarity on the process. We did have a debate, and during that debate, I raised the issue of the importance of defining the Democratic Party as the party of the people, not the party of Wall Street. You know, is it about jobs or wars? Is it about homes or banks? Is it your street or is it Wall Street? We got a lot of people very excited. The vote count was not one that I would say was pristine by any or methodical. It happened in a matter of minutes, well over a thousand votes cast. The Democratic Party called the vote for Jane Harman. They said I got 41% of the floor. I know it was much greater than that, but even if it were just 41%, that was huge given the fact that so many of these delegates are institutional delegates, meaning that they are appointed by elected officials or they are elected officials themselves or they run on slates that are associated with elected officials.
Right. And there is, the sense that you have to watch each other's back because there's all sorts of competing allegiances and calling in favors and things like that. Marcy Winograd, let me ask you about your election campaign method and what are the sort of methods that you're using and tactics that you're using to get the vote out, because you're competing against somebody who's won this seat many times and who obviously is entrenched and has a lot of money behind her, and I'm assuming your wealth doesn't compare to Jane Harman's.
You got that right.
How do you match this type of campaign? How do you use your campaign to match this kind of power?
Sonali, in college at the University of California at Berkeley and later at UCLA, I mean, I studied political science. That was my major, although I later got a teaching credential and have been a high school teacher and a middle school teacher for 15 years. I remember reading Machiavelli, and though I didn't admire many of his beliefs, I do remember his writing that you have to use stealth and surprise when you are faced with an enemy, you know, twice your size or much larger than that in terms of resources. So given that stealth and surprise are two very important factors here, I'm not going to say everything, but I will say this. We have a headquarters. We have infrastructure. We're located in Marina del Rey at 13428 Maxella at the corner of Glencoe and Maxella in the Via Marina Shopping Center. We're open most of the time. We invite anyone who is listening to come on down, help us out, phone bank. We are phone banking into the district and have been for a couple of months now. We have over 100 volunteers. This is a grassroots campaign. I'm not running with any corporate money. My opponent is awash in corporate contributions, principally from military contractors. I am running a non-corporate campaign, not taking a dime of corporate money, but we are mobilizing volunteers, 100, as I said, in the district, many more than that throughout the nation, phone banking and talking to voters right now, even though the primary is June 8th. And believe me, the race is the primary in a gerrymandered district. A Democrat will win this seat. The question is, will it be a Democrat who has led us to war over and over again and continues to vote for escalations in Afghanistan? Or will it be a Democrat who is truly committed to addressing people's needs in this district? We are phoning voters right now because time is crucial. Absentee voting begins today. A third of our electorate will vote before June 8th. So if you're thinking, gee, I might want to get involved in this race a few months from now, please Get involved now. We need you now on the phone. And if you cannot come into our headquarters, that's fine too. You can set up a phone account and start calling. We're using the Obama software that the president used during his campaign in California. So all you have to do is email Bill at winogradforcongress.com. That's winogradforcongress.com. And if you have any questions about the campaign and how to get involved, please call us at 310-822-3400. That's 310-822-3400. I do want to add, Sonali, one more thing, and that is in 06, you know, we had such a short time span in which to run. We didn't have time to reach out to all of the key communities. This time, we have hired Rick Reyes, or Ricardo Reyes. He is our Latino outreach director. He's also vice president of the Iraq Veterans Against the War and a Marine who served in Iraq. And he is working overtime in Wilmington and San Pedro. Wilmington is 90% Latino. We need to get out the vote. The issue is not so much support, because we know where our support lies. The issue is getting people to the polls and getting them to vote.
My guest is Marcy Winograd. She is the co-founder of the LA chapter of Progressive Democrats of America, community activist, former teacher. She is challenging Jane Harman in the primary election on June 8th for the ability to represent California's 36th district with the Democratic Party. And we'll put all the information that she mentioned on our website, uprisingradio.org, later today. Let me spend the last few minutes asking you, Marcy, why the Democratic Party, given that for progressives, many progressives are so disillusioned with the Democratic Party, and certainly understanding that in electoral politics, it's very difficult to run with a third party. But how do you sort of justify the mantle of a party that has been so complicit with the Republicans on so many issues antithetical to progressives?
Sonali, I'm not here to justify any of that. In fact, I abhor the complicity that we have witnessed over the last years. But I will say this, logistically, strategically, it's just tremendously challenging in this country, as you know, to launch a third-party challenge on a federal level. This is a federal race. I think third parties can be viable and effective on a local level, perhaps on a state level. We see their viability in places like Arcata, where the Green Party is very strong. We have worked in Los Angeles with the Green Party, Progressive Democrats of Los Angeles, on key issues, certainly election protection being one of them. I would say that, you know, you have as good a chance working from within and pushing a progressive agenda. The Progressive Caucus of the California Democratic Party did not exist a few years ago. I worked with others around the state and Progressive Democrats of America to organize that caucus, and we are advancing single-payer health care. We want to make sure that states have the right to enact single-payer. That has been one of the key planks of our platform that we have pushed to the platform level of the state party. So, you know, it's a matter of education and awareness, and be it third party, be it the Democratic Party, we need to work together on key issues.
And let me ask you a very basic question. Does one have to be registered as a Democrat to vote in the primary?
I'm so glad you asked that. No. In the Democratic Party primary on June 8th, declined to states can vote. As I mentioned, we have 70,000 declined to states in our district, in the 36th congressional district. If you're a declined to state, vote June 8th.
Marcy Winograd, I want to also ask you about the other grassroots mobilization that's happening around the country. And, you know, progressives may turn up their noses and discount their importance, but the Tea Party movement has really ridden a wave of right-wing populism in this country. And they're taking the approach of challenging congressional seats, Democratic congressional seats, and trying to, and also challenging what they see as moderate Republicans and trying to get in extremely right-wing Republicans. Do you think that progressives need to do more of what you're doing to counter what the Tea Party is doing?
Absolutely. You know, if you don't push back, and pushback sounds defensive, if you don't launch a viable challenge to sitting Democrats who are complicit in the crimes of the Bush administration, who make backroom deals with the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, who vote for Wall Street and make it easier for big banks to foreclose on our homes at a time when we're looking at foreclosures across the nation, skyrocketing 7,000 in my district, 25,000 projected in my district over the next 4 years. If we don't challenge that, then we just push the dialogue further to the right. And I will say this, and that this holds true on immigration reform. Mm-hmm. This is a hot issue right now. And what are we seeing out of the Democratic Party? We're seeing increased emphasis on enforcement. Bills that are being pushed calling for biometric ID, eye scans, vein scans, drones patrolling our borders. This is not the right direction. Well, actually, it is the, quote, right direction. We need another direction. And that's why I am asking others to join in this campaign and to support progressives around the country who are challenging Blue Dog Democrats.
Well, Marcy Winograd, best of luck to you. I want to thank you so much for joining us
today. Thank you so much, Sonali.
And that website
is great to be with you.
WinogradForCongress.com.
That's correct. And Marcy Winograd for Congress on Facebook. Please become a fan.
And we'll post all of that information on our site later today. And in the interest of offering equal time, we certainly invite the Jane Harman campaign to appear on our program as well. This is Uprising for Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. Walter H. Judd once said, "People often say that in a democracy, decisions are made by a majority of the people. Of course, that's not true. Decisions are made by a majority of those who make themselves heard and who vote, a very different thing." The election is on June 8th. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Steve Pride is our intern. Jose Benavides is our engineer. And Martina Steiner is our director. You can order a copy of today's show at 1-800-735-0230 or at PacificaRadioArchives.org. Join us at Facebook.com/UprisingRadio. Follow us at Twitter.com/UprisingRadio and email us at mail@UprisingRadio.org. Listen to the show online. Find links, local events, and other info at UprisingRadio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. See you tomorrow at 8, and stay tuned for Democracy Now!